On this episode, we are going to share an interview with a true Linux legend, John Mad Dog Hall. Those of you who know this name already know how important John is. And those who don't know, well, you want to check this episode because you will definitely want to learn about his story.
Yeah, I just want to add, this interview ended up being one of my all-time favorite interviews. And we've had a lot of great interviews. That's not to take away from any of the amazing interviews. But I know we all left that room going, this is incredible.
Yes.
John has a way of storytelling that is just artful. And you're absolutely going to love it. So whether you know the name and know how much of a legend this person is, you don't, you're going to want to listen to this episode.
Absolutely. It's one of my favorites as well, too. Mm-hmm. And of course, welcome to episode 366 of Destination Linux, your favorite video podcast. My name is Michael.
I'm Jill.
And I'm Ryan.
And now let's get this show on the road toward Destination Linux and have our conversation with Mad Dog. But first, our community feedback. And this week comes from Bruce.
Michael, I got this. Just step aside. This is a question I know how to answer because...
That's asking Michael or Ryan to answer the question.
But this is for me because I'm the one that controls the piping stuff. You're going to see why you don't want to get into this. I'm the expert here.
Okay.
Well, me and Jill are the experts. Let's see. It should have been said to me and Jill because Jill's an audio expert too. Michael... He buys like $3 headphones at Walmart for his stuff. So that's how I met him. Of course, he's a little more bougie now. But when I met him, that was Michael's. He don't know nothing about audio. He does not appreciate good audio. All right.
So I am so annoyed by that joke.
Yeah.
You have no idea. I have this relatively expensive mixer. And it plugged into that is a $9 pair of headphones I got from Amazon.
Bruce, do you see what I mean, Bruce? You should not address Michael to this. He is not an audiophile in any stretch of the imagination.
It's so perfect that you said that. I was like, wait a minute. I think the last one I bought was $9.
From Walmart, probably.
Yeah. No, from Amazon. Yeah. Amazon.
Same.
I didn't even go out of the house to get it.
Bruce says, this isn't really for the podcast unless you want it to be, in which case, awesome job all, especially Jill. You could have said especially Ryan here because I'm the one that's about to deliver you your answer that you need, but I'm going to let it go.
But that's Bruce. Not the joke, though. Especially Jill is because Jill is awesome.
And they
you're
did
not
put
as
a smiley
awesome.
Face.
Yeah. You're not as awesome as Jill. So.
Nobody is as awesome as Jill. So.
That's true. I'm not as awesome either. I was just pointing out that you are not as awesome as Jill.
Thank you for pointing that out. People might have been confused, but now they know. Because seriously, though, I have a second-gen Scarlett 18i20, and I'm trying to learn about QPW Graph, which I'm running on Debian-based distro MX Linux. I can see 10 playback outputs from the 18i20, which are the 10 analog outs, but I'm not sure how I can view patch the digital outs, the SPDIF or optical outs. I've attached a screenshot. Any ideas? Thanks in anticipation. Cheers. Do you think because they said cheers that they're from England?
It could be, but also it's become like a common thing that people are just saying in general now.
Yeah, cheers. This is
it's become a thing. It's more likely that they're from UK, but also they might just
I like
be
the
doing
cheers.
That.
It's a very nice way of, you know.
It's a fun personable way of doing it without also being like, it's not formal or anything. So I like it.
Yeah.
It's cheers. Good. Cheers.
I've been Michael. Using it all cheers, my life bye. Since I've been a little kid on letters.
Oh, have you?
Yeah.
Of course.
Of course you have, Jill.
All right. So first of all, the 18i20, that's a really nice piece of equipment. One of the first pieces of equipment that was sub $500 that has interfaces that are optical out. So a lot of people wanted to grab one of these in the audio world.
I know what
world.
That means.
And in the screenshot that you sent over, I did notice something that may be a clue as to your problem. So
I noticed something too. None of the connections were there.
That Michael, would you quit raining on my parade, sir?
I'm just saying. I
told
noticed
you that
too
in the pre-show, and now
no, you
you're
didn't.
Trying to
I,
say it. As
I
if
mentioned
you know
how I saw the screenshot, and I said, Joe. "Well, he just by opening notes. The application, I see the wires connected on my end, and there were no wires, so that's the problem." Yeah. What that means and how to fix it? Well, that's what Ryan's going to talk to you about now.
So what's interesting in QPW Graph is if you're not using Pipewire, which I have been distro hopping before, have pulled up QPW Graph in order to make the connections I do to bring our patrons into the show and things. And there's no connection showing, meaning even if I'm in Zencaster, YouTube's playing, whatever, there's no connections. And generally that tells me you don't have Pipewire going, because that's what is basically the interfacing with it to create all of those connections. That's where it can read when you have Pipewire, all of the various connections that you have and where they're going. And the fact that your screenshot showed no connections at all tells me that likely you're not using Pipewire. Now, we did do some research, which Michael was helping with before the show.
You helped on
MX Linux, because I wasn't sure MX Linux comes with Pipewire by default. I know they have an AV version of MX Linux, which is your kind of audio file version that definitely comes with Pipewire, but I don't know if their newest editions do. But it seems, based on our research, that in fact the latest versions of MX do have Pipewire.
So it's kind of confusing, but it does appear that they do, but also I'm not totally sure, because the way that the release notes are is as minimal as you could possibly have them. So I would like to recommend MX Linux put more details into their release notes, and to also anyone who's making any software, whether it's a distro or not, if you would like for people who are not familiar with your stuff to be able to talk about it, put a little bit more detail so that we could get some stuff around it and, you know, that kind of
thing. We love Dolphin. So
yeah, Dolphin Oracle from MX Linux. We've talked to him many times. He's been on the show many times. So that's, we're not making fun of MX Linux or anything. It's just the idea of when you're implementing something about Pipewire 1.0, for example, and then the only thing on the release notes is the word Pipewire in 1.0. It's not that clear if this is a default or not. So yeah. In this case, I think it's default based on other release notes I could find, but I also can't guarantee that. So I'm just going to say 75% likely that it is.
So the first thing is, you may not be running. You didn't tell us what version of MX you had, which is fine. You can type in the command PACTL, that's Pactl, space info, and then you're going to use the pipe delimiter, the little line that goes straight down, and type grep space, and in quotes, server space name. And that will tell you if you're on Pipewire or not. So,
and that will be in the show notes.
There you go. So you can check to see if you have Pipewire going. So my first thing, make sure you have Pipewire going. If that doesn't work for you, then I did notice there were a lot of people back when the 18i20 first released that were in Linux that were like, hey, I want to use this thing. I can't get it to work in Pulse Audio, which isn't surprising because it's not made for those type of interfaces. And people were successfully getting the optical outs working using Jack. Now, this is where I'm no longer the expert and Jill becomes the expert. But Jill, Jack is just a very powerful set of tools. It's a little difficult to get up and running, in my opinion, and setting it up. But once you do, you have everything at your fingertips. So that may be another option for him to try.
Yeah, and QJackCTL is a really good place to start once you install Jack for your connections.
Yeah. Would you recommend a different distribution that has Jack by default? Is it that level of necessity?
It does help, because you really need a real-time kernel, Linux kernel installed. And if you've never done that before, it can be kind of daunting.
Gotcha. Yeah, install. That makes sense.
And there's some other, you've got to set your processor to also use the real-time profiles as well. So there's just a lot more involved. It takes several hours to set up a proper Jack system.
Don't let that make you shy away from doing this, Bruce.
Yes.
Unless you want it to shy away.
But Michael, I feel like you're about to give advice that there is a distro you can install and it's kind of all done for you. And
there are a couple options. Yeah, there's Ubuntu Studio.
Ubuntu Studio is the one I was going to recommend.
There's also Fedora Jam.
Yeah, Fedora Jam.
I'm not sure how up-to-date Fedora Jam is in terms of maintenance. I'm not sure if it's actually active or not. But it basically does the same thing as Ubuntu Studio, but for Fedora. And I think OpenSUSE has one as well, as like a spin. But those are the only ones I know of, except for the ones that are specifically made for this, like AV Linux is made for that particular purpose.
That's excellent. That's a good one. Yeah.
And there are some, I think there's another one that's also specifically made for it, but I don't remember the name of it off the top of my head. But I think that this is a good idea if you want to check out Jack. If the Pipewire stuff is not working, it's also possible to just test another distribution that we know for a fact has Pipewire. Mm-hmm. Like if you just installed the latest version of Fedora or even an older version of Fedora, that's fine. It's had it since 35. So you could just load up a Fedora, and if it runs and it shows you the features, then it's a Pipewire issue, because we know for a fact that Pipewire has been in Fedora for a very long time. So it will be a good test to see if it's the Pipewire issue or not. If it's the Pipewire.
Yeah.
Or not the Pipewire in this case, because that's the only
you
reason.
Trying to get you to say it in the Mario voice. It's the button.
Oh.
But why would that be?
Poopa de Peppo.
Poopa de Peppo.
It's the Pipewire.
There you go. Because it's pipes and Mario. And I just had it in my head, and I thought you were going to be there with me, but you weren't. But you know what?
It's the
community may be there with me. And if you want to send in your feedback or comments or have questions that we can help answer, then go to destinationlinux.net/comments and you can send them in to us. And one of us will answer. And be careful just putting Michael or Ryan or just Jill, because maybe Jill doesn't know and maybe Michael knows this time. You never know. You need to address all of us, okay?
You could also just say DL Crew. That might be easier.
No, it's fine. You can address anybody you want. In fact, I generally suggest you don't mention Michael, because then he'll take the...
Oh. I generally suggest that you don't mention Ryan and specifically only mention Jill. That way Ryan gets bothered as so much, because it's like not even especially Jill, it's just Jill.
Just Jill. Awesome. Well, thank you for sending that in, Bruce. And I do hope you get that awesome 18i20 working, because that is a nice piece of kit.
Yes.
I see what you did there. The cheers kit.
Kit. Yeah.
Okay.
Speaking sure his did. Language. This episode is brought to you by Namecheap. Now, Namecheap is where we go to get all of our domains. And if you know anything about Michael, who's responsible for our domains, there's a lot of them. There's like a lot. And Namecheap is a fantastic place to go and get the domains you need to start your new business and start it cheaply. You can get URLs, you can do self-hosting, you can have WordPress set up for you, or you can just get the domain itself and set all that stuff up elsewhere. They have all kinds of options, whether you're a blogger, small business owner, you have big dreams on the internet. Well, Namecheap is the place to check out. So head to destinationlinux.net/Namecheap to get started and check out all the options that you have for starting your next big business or even small business or blog or whatever it is. It's all there.
Whether you have a big idea or the next big business, the price is not big at Namecheap.
So 2 weeks ago, we talked about our highlights from the Southern California Linux Expo Scale 21X. And I mentioned we got to interview with one of the greats in Linux and a very special person who is extremely pivotal in Linux's adoption. So this week, as Michael mentioned earlier, that person is John Mad Dog Hall, who is a legend in Linux. And I have been wanting to sit down and record his amazing journey for many, many years. We really hope you enjoy the interview as much as we did. This was one of my favorite interviews of all time that I've done awesome. Here on the show.
Also, just real quick, for those who are wondering why we're referring to him as Mad Dog, that is an interesting story, because the Wikipedia says that that he doesn't like that. And in fact, when we were talking to him during the pre-interview, he specifically said he likes that and doesn't understand why the Wikipedia even says that in the first place. So... yeah,
which is weird, because Wikipedia is always right. It's an academic, peer-reviewed
article. Wikipedia has so much research. And also, it's even on his LinkedIn, and that's a good example of, like, he controls that for sure, and he's okay with it then.
There you go. Hey, roll that beautiful Mad Dog footage.
So we're here at Scale with John Mad Dog Hall. And John, I got to tell you, I know about your story, doing a lot of research and things, but I know mostly about you because of Jill here. Because Jill is your biggest fan in the entire world, talks about you constantly, and I think this is one of the most exciting things about Scale for her this year. But I want to thank you for sitting down with us and having this interview, because the one thing that I've learned doing research on your career is you are a legend in open source. Whether you accept it or not, you're a legend in open source. Yes. You currently serve as the board chair for the Linux Professional Institute, and really you've been pivotal to the success of Linux over the years. So thank you again for agreeing to interview with us.
That's fine, but I want to say right up front that I'm only a person that was happened to be in the right place at the right time, and I tried to do the right thing, okay? Yeah. And that's all. You know, and there's so many other people who have given so much to free and open source software that, you know, I appreciate what you said, but I think of myself the way that Linus thinks of himself. Mm-hmm. He thinks of himself as an engineer.
Yeah.
Yes.
And he really doesn't like the bowing down stuff, yeah. Right?
Well, we needed people like you that would step up and take those opportunities when they did come along, and you did in many cases. And in fact, the first question I kind of want to start with is, can you share some of your insights about your initial encounter with Linux? Because when we have people on this show, we get to hear their origin stories, and I want to know your origin story. What was it that your first encounter was that you said, hey, there's some potential with this thing here?
Well, first of all, you have to understand that my encounter with what we call open source today happened back in 1969 when I was a university student at Drexel University. I took a correspondence course in how to program the IBM 1130 in Fortran. And that's all capital letters Fortran, not Fortran 2, Fortran 4, Fortran 77, Fortran 90, high performance Fortran, just Fortran. Because that's the only language you would ever need, obviously, except maybe COBOL. And that's why I started. And it was through reading these books and practicing on these computers and having help of the small staff that we had in the computer we had at Western Electric that got me started in programming. And then when I went back to Drexel, we didn't really have computer science. It wasn't computer science back in those days. It was like computer black magic, okay? Yeah. And so a lot of what I learned was from reading books and practicing on the little computers we had, PDP-8s and PDP-11s and stuff like that in the computer lab. And that's how I got started. But the biggest thing that really helped me was this organization called DECUS, the Digital Equipment Corporation User Society. And they would print this paper catalog that you could order through the mail. It cost $15, which was a lot of money back in those days. Yeah. And then you could go through the catalog and see the programs that their members had written and contributed to the DECUS library. And so you say, oh, here's a really cool text editor, runs on the PDP-8. Okay, it's $5. And you would send your $5 away to them, and they would punch this paper tape and mail it back to you in the mail. And you got to use it, and you got to make as many copies as you wanted to, because number one, copyright wasn't assigned to programs back in those days. And number two, the people wanted you to use their code, right? So I would go to the school store, and I would get brand new paper tape and run it through my ASR 33 teletype at 5 characters a second to make copies of these that I'd sell to my roommates for $1 a copy. So by the time I sold 6 or 7 copies, I paid for the original copy, I'd gotten all the paper tape and stuff. So I became, in effect, the first Red Hat, even though Red Hat was still many, you know, years in the future. I understood how DECUS worked, and I understood. DECUS only had 3 paid staff members that did all of this stuff, kept the library, punched the tapes and stuff. And they were, and they put on events every year that, you know, we had 19,000 people come to a DECUS event twice a year to talk with each other. It was all volunteer driven and stuff like this. And it was really incredible. And that was really what helped me get started in programming and stuff. So that's how I got started. And then I eventually taught at a small 2-year technical college. Eventually I went to work for Bell Labs. That's where I learned Unix. But I kept going back to DECUS because DECUS is where you got information about the hardware the DEC was coming out with. And that's what we used at Bell Labs. And then from there, I joined the USENIX Association and eventually became a board director there. And, you know, so then I went to work for DEC in their Unix group in 1983 because DEC was going to bring out their own version of Unix, which they called Ultrix. And I was there to help make Unix easier to use and easier to maintain so that DEC could sell support on their Unix systems. And it was there while at DEC and mostly sewing Unix on PDP-11s and then faxes that along came the Alpha. And the Alpha was a 64-bit system. So the PDP-11s were 16-bit, 64K address space. Faxes were 32-bit, 4 gigabyte address space. And then you had the Alpha, which was 64-bit or 4 billion times 4 billion, okay? And to give your, you know, readers and podcasters and stuff an idea of how big that is, 4 billion times 4 billion allows you to store 36,000 bytes of data for every square meter on the surface of the Earth, including all the oceans.
Cool. What a neat fact.
And you can just M-map that entire space into the virtual address space of the Alpha, okay? And that gives people a lot of flexibility in trying to do their programming because they don't have to do edge programming. They don't get to the edge of the 4 billion bytes and say, well, we have to store this data and flop it across to the next, you know, 4 billion byte address space. They can just say, however big it is, you know, just map it in, okay? And that's why, you know, and we had digital Unix for that. It was based on OSF1. That was the commercial version. But the problem was that we still had the AT&T source code license. We were still under that. We still had the source code license from Digital, which was not cheap. And I wanted people to do research in how to use 64-bit address spaces, you know, because I saw that as one of the main selling points of the Alpha. The Alpha was really fast, but the address space, to me, was a big selling point. And I was looking around at different operating systems. I thought about BSD, but BSD was still under the AT&T license. They were still going through the courts of AT&T and USL. So that was kind of out. And all of a sudden, this guy from Deicas, by the name of Kurt Riesler, and I'm going to have a call out to Kurt. Kurt Riesler, who is the chair of the Unix Special Interest Group, Kurt said, hey, I got this guy, he's over in Europe, and, you know, I'd like to bring him to Deicas in New Orleans, right? Mm-hmm. Now, have you ever been to New Orleans?
I love New Orleans.
Yeah.
Best food in the world.
It's the adult Disneyland. Yeah. There's two of them, Las Vegas and New Orleans, especially the French Quarter
like
of New
Orleans.
Orleans
more than Vegas, but yes.
I do too. So I says, okay, you know, who is this person? Well, in Europe, all right. I don't know who he is or what he did, but I went to my management and says, I don't know who this guy is or what he did, but, you know, Kurt oftentimes has good ideas, so I think we should fund this guy to come over. And so my management went to their management and says, we don't know who this guy is or what he did, and we don't even know who Kurt is, but Mad Dog sometimes has good ideas, so I think we should do this. So we got the money, we got the airline tickets, we got a hotel for him and stuff, and he went down to Deicas. Now, in the meantime, I was getting Dr. Dobb's Journal of Computer Calisthenics and Orthodontia. And in November of 1993, copy, they had this one-page ad that said, complete Unix system with all the source code, only $99. I go, what? That's impossible.
Yeah.
You know? And I mean, the BSD thing is still, BSDI thing is still going on, right? And there's this ad, complete Unix system with all the source code for $99. I mean, this is illegal at best, okay? But hey, it was just $99. So I sent away my money and I got this thin little book and this little CD-ROM. And the only problem I had was I didn't own an Intel computer. I couldn't boot the CD-ROM.
Wow.
Okay. So I took the CD and I mounted it on my Ultrix system because after all, it had a, you know, a file system that I could read with Ultrix. I looked at all the man pages and said, oh, this is pretty interesting, you know, these man pages on here. I folded the whole thing up, put it back in my cabinet because I didn't have anything to run it on. So I'm about to go down to Deicas. when Kurt asked the final insult to me. Mad Dog, we need a PC to run this software on. What? I work for the digital group. We make VAX systems, MIPS systems, and Alpha systems. We don't make these weak, miserable, crappy Intel systems, okay? And you're asking me to put out money to show this software working on this weak, miserable, crappy PC? Oh, please, please. All right.
So Mad Dog's really a softie because you said all right.
Yeah. Hey, this was $6,000 out of my budget to rent this stupid PC for like 3 or 4 days so they can put this software I'd never heard of on it, okay? We get down there. I'm walking around. There's Kurt trying to put this software on this PC and not getting very far. When all of a sudden, this young guy with sandy brown hair, wire-rimmed glasses, wearing sandals with socks, shows up, and a lilting European accent with perfect English says, "Can I help you?" And Kurt looks at him and smiles, says, "Yeah, I think you can." And about 10 minutes later, Linux was running on his weak, miserable, crappy Intel PC. And they invited me to sit down and use it, okay? Now, my talk here at Scale is about why is Linux like a player piano. Okay. And so if you've ever played a piano, you know that most pianos, if they're well tuned and stuff, you get reasonable sound out of them. But a very good piano with all the keys weighted the right way and completely even and stuff like that, it's just a joy to be able to play that thing. This weak, miserable, crappy Intel PC was a joy to play, okay? If I thought of it like System 5, it was System 5. If I thought of it like Berkeley, it was Berkeley. Everything was fast and peppy and stuff. And I go, you gotta be kidding me. This is a weak, miserable, crappy Intel PC. And yet it's so good. So, now, Linus had two talks, which he had that time. And actually, I've been lucky enough to recover the audio of those talks and even the slides of those talks, and I put them up on the web. And I went to see them and stuff, and there was Linus, you know, shaking because this is the first time he'd actually given a talk in English to a native English-speaking audience, and he was terrified. But everybody liked it. Each talk had about 40 people to come to it. Out of an audience of 19,000 computer geeks, right? 40 people showed up to hear this person that they never heard of talk about Linux, right? And I said, you know, this might be the platform that I need to put on the alpha to do this research that I want to do. Because you get the whole operating system and all the compilers and the kernel and everything. You know, but of course it has to be ported off of Intel and onto Alpha. And so you're not only going from a CISC processor to a RISC processor, but you're also going from 32-bit to 64. And so one of the reasons I like going to New Orleans is because of the Natchez, the steam riverboat that goes up and down the Mississippi River, and you get on board the Natchez, and you hear the steam calliope playing songs, and you have this really wonderful buffet dinner, and you drink hurricane.
Yes, lots of hurricanes.
Hurricanes.
Yes.
And so Linus and I go on board the boat. We're going up and down the river. We have the buffet. We listen to Calliope. I take him back and show him the steam engine because I love steam engines. And we get up on the bow of the boat, and we're going up and down the river. And I says, Linus, and we both have a hurricane in our hand. And it's a plastic glass because you're on a boat. You don't want a glass. And I said, Linus, have you ever thought about taking Linux and porting it to a 64-bit system like the Alpha? He goes, well, yes, I thought about doing that, but Digital in Helsinki has been having problems getting me an alpha because it's so new and, you know, it's so hard to get and everything. So I may have to do the IBM PowerPC instead. Sorry, the sound of that. But I dropped my hurricane, and anybody that knows me, I never drop a drink. I dropped the hurricanes. Don't do anything rash. So this was the last day of DECUS. I flew back to the office. Now, people will tell you the way you get things done in a large organization is you write a proposal, you have a business plan, you show the revenues and the expenses and the probability and the audience and things like that. That's all crap. The way you get things done in a large, diverse organization like Digital is you call in favors. Mm. And I've been working for Digital for 16 years at that point, and I started to call in my favors. And one of the people who owed me favors was a guy named Jim Jackson. And I called him up. I says, "Hi, Jim. You've never heard of this guy. You've never heard of the software he's written, but I need to have an alpha processor sent to Digital in Helsinki, Finland, right now, like tomorrow, Jim." And he's laughing on the phone. He says, "Well, it just so happens I had a seed unit come back from a developer. It's sitting right beside my desk. It's a nice little system." He says, I says, "What does it have?" Now, remember, this is 1994. Mm-hmm. Alpha processor, ESA bus. It had 96 megabytes of main memory. It had a 4 gigabyte hard drive. It had a 4X CD-ROM reader. It had a 21-inch color monitor with a diamond video board, okay?
Yes.
You know, and you put all this stuff together, and the price tag on the system was $30,000.
Yes. Mm.
And Jim was sending this to Helsinki, Finland on my say-so, right? With no justification whatsoever. I said, "Jim, that's a great system. You throw in a 4 millimeter tape drive so we can do backups, and you got a deal." That 4 millimeter tape drive, $6,000.
Oh my goodness.
Right? So Jim's laughing by this point. He says, "What are you gonna pay for?" I says, "I'll pay for the shipping." So 2 days later, that shipment was out of deck, headed to Helsinki, Finland, and it gets to the deck office. And we made a strategic mistake. We had actually put Linus's name on this. And because we did that, it was going to a customer. And we had to pay, the deck office had to pay customs duties. Mm-hmm. If we had left Digital's name on it, done a loan of products out of the office, they wouldn't have had to pay that because there's intercompany transition there. But they swallowed it. They paid the $15,000 customs duty. Because they were so happy to get access to this alpha system for Linus. And then we started the port, and Linus needed some help with some down, deep, and dirty stuff, okay? But in the meantime, I was emailing him all this documentation of the architecture, documentation of the instruction set, all this type of stuff, and he was reading all this stuff. So, and there was still one minor thing he had to do. He had to come to Boston and sign a load of products form that said that Digital actually loaned him the system and he was responsible for it and stuff. And as he's signing this with a hot dog in one hand and a pen in the other, he says, "Am I ever going to have to give this system back?" I says, "Linus, and all the time I've worked for the deck, I've never seen a load of product system come back." Right?
Yes.
So don't worry about it. It's in effect yours forever. We put together a small team of engineers, a lot of them from the semiconductor division, including another shout out to David Rustling, who was a member of the semiconductor group. And he was going to write a bootloader because the bootloader that came from Digital, number one, was closed source, and number two, cost $120 on top of the hardware. So he was going to write a free one that was going to be open source. Instead of Lilo, he called it Milo. Yeah. And so he wrote that. And actually, we may talk about him again in the future, but he eventually left Digital Semiconductor, went to work for ARM, became an ARMS fellow, and started the Linero Corporation that helps ARM licensees port their software onto ARM systems. So you'll see that he flows back. And he credits me with giving him, starting him in his open source quest.
Wow. That's an amazing story.
I have something exciting. I have a DECUS Alpha.
Oh, good.
And it's the dual processor 500 megahertz that came out in 1995. And I used to use it to render animation because I worked in the industry. Mm-hmm.
and it's got the full height Micropolis SCSI drives.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Full height Seagate SCSI drives. And the thing is so loud when I turn it on and the drives spin up. They're so big and powerful. The server actually rolls across my wooden floor because it's a server with casters on it. It actually rolls and I have to block them so it doesn't roll.
So that's interesting because last year here at Scale, this guy comes up to me at the LPI table and I look at him and I go, I know you. It was Daryl Strauss who worked for Digital Domain and they did the rendering of the Titanic on 60 alpha servers running Linux.
Yes.
Right?
Okay.
Yeah.
And I said, Daryl, you know, and we went out for beers together, which was great.
Oh, that's awesome.
That's awesome.
And yeah, I remember after you had done the keynote speech for the Southern California Linux Expo 14X, and I talked to you after that because I was so excited I had to tell him that I had a working deck alpha.
When was the last time you booted it?
Actually about a year ago.
Nice.
So I do need to put some new memory in it, and memory, as you know, for the alpha is getting very expensive.
Yeah.
Did you make a call? Get her some memory like this.
I think Jim is retired. Yeah.
This episode of Destination Linux is sponsored by Linbit. Linbit has been keeping digital businesses running for over 20 years. They're the makers of open source products like DRBD, which is high availability software that has been part of the Linux kernel since 2010, and LinStore, industry-leading open source software-defined storage. Linbit has an active presence in the open source community, and they collaborate with the community to help identify and build new features. Linbit provides enterprise-grade software that runs on a variety of platforms and OSs without vendor lock-in. What that means is that you could choose the software on any platform, including specific hardware that you want to use, or just off-the-shelf hardware that you get and connect it. All of this stuff can be interchanged really easily. And with DRBD and LinStore, you can have high-speed replicated block storage in almost any configuration, whether it's Kubernetes, Apache Cloud, or Open Nebula. There's even DRBD proxy for long-distance replication. Linbit is run by its founders to this day, and all of its engineers and developers are in-house with offices in Europe and North America, which allows them to have global 24/7 support to complement their enterprise offerings. Visit linbit.com to learn more about the people behind Linbit and the awesome software for block storage, duplication, and more.
So what's your next question?
The next question is related to, you were talking about Linus Torvalds and your collaboration with him, and this fascinating story. And I want to pull a little bit onto that thread and to ask you about, like, how did your involvement, your collaboration with Linus have a change to the trajectory of Linux itself? And also, how did your involvement help with getting it beyond academia?
Okay, so there's two parts to that. The first thing was that this was the first port of Linux that Linus actually cooperated in. Mm. A lot of people had taken the source code from the Intel tree. They started putting it to the Sun and stuff. But the problem with that is you now have two threads to this, right? And Linus decided that with the alpha port, he was going to take the source code tree and not just make it two architectures, but make it N architectures, right? So in the future, you could say, oh, well, this is going to be an ARM architecture. It's going to be a Spark architecture. This is going to be that. And that way, the rest of the operating system would be exactly the same, right?
Nice.
And that was very important, okay? And the other thing was, when he said to me, I'm going to make it N architecture, I said to myself, oh my God, I knew you were smart before, but this is brilliant, okay? So that was one thing. But the other thing was that, like I said, you know, people thought of Linux as being a hobbyist thing, you know, an amateur thing.
It's for people who like to mess with computers.
Yeah. I go. Okay, let's talk about amateurs. Okay, let's talk about amateur football players. And I'm not talking about American football. I'm talking about, you know, the real football.
Right.
Okay, that we call soccer. You know, there's a lot of amateurs out there that are every good as professionals. It's just they don't make their living playing football. Right. They play it as a hobby, as a sport. And you say, okay, they're amateur. You know, people who write software doesn't mean that they're worse at writing software. In fact, if you take a look at, you know, software that comes from the free software community, we're not under the pressure of a time scale that we have to bring out a release right now because this piece of hardware depends on it. And if you don't have it out, well, then that hardware can't be sold. So you better get that release out there in that period of time.
Yeah.
No. And so when you take a look at some of the projects that have been happened in the past, like the time that they ripped out the entire IO subsystem and rewrote it into more of a tree type of thing, where you say, okay, we're starting to shut the system down. Well, we can't shut off this controller until every single device that's been attached to that has been shut down in a reasonable way. So by having it as a tree, you go, shut down the device, shut down the device. Okay, now you can shut down the controller. Now you can shut this down. Now you can shut down the bus. You know that. And by doing it that way, particularly with SCSI drives, the original specification of the SCSI drive was pretty SCSI.
Yeah.
And so you had a lot of device drivers that half the device driver was rewritten by some Seagate or whatever because they needed that for their thing. So, you know, there was lots of inconsistencies that only happened because the tree was broken too early. And when they rewrote it, the SCSI specification had become so much better that they were able to reduce the amount of different code to minimum amounts for each device and stuff. And then as some of those devices were retired, they just could eliminate that code completely, right? So this is the type of thing. Now, if I had tried to suggest that in digital Unix, if I said to my management, oh, can we rewrite the entire IO subsystem? And we're going to take these 15 engineers off of whatever else they're supposed to be doing to sell more hardware. can we do that? They would have thrown my desk out on the street. You know, I would have been out in the parking lot trying to do the work after that. You know, that's crazy talk. You don't do that. Yeah. Free software people do it because they want to have it right.
Mm-hmm.
And when I asked Linus about this, I said, did you, I mean, he didn't automatically think of the GPL as a license to put this under. He was convinced to do that over time. But so he wasn't out to get a gratis operating system. He was out to get a good operating system, right? And that's been his driving point ever since. So I have, you know, again, I just knew I had made the right direction. And it wasn't that BSD was bad or anything, but it's just that it happened to fall in the wrong period of time that the court case of USL versus BSDI was still going on. And then way after DECUS in 1994, they satisfied the case and BSD Lite came out of that freed up BSD for other things. But by that time, I was just completely embraced in this.
Yeah, the train had already gone through, yeah.
In my mind, anyway. And when the BSD people came to me and said, hey, why aren't you putting as much force behind BSD as you are Linux? I say, well, guys, you know, here's all these Linux magazines. Show me one magazine on BSD. There's all these Linux lugs. Show me five BSD lugs throughout the United States. I says, you know, and I'm sorry, you guys have an emblem, this cute little demon with a pitchfork, you know.
Yeah.
And we have a cuddly penguin.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, you know, and a lot of the guys who represent BSD, particularly at that point, had long, greasy beards and stuff, and they looked kind of like disciples of the demon. And I have this young, nice young man who speaks with this lilting European accent in perfect English that looks like the type of person you would really like to have marry your daughter. And I, as a marketing person at Digital, I'm tired of swimming upstream all the time. I want to just swim downstream for once, right? So that was it.
Thanks.
And I have nothing against BSD or, you know, BSD operating systems. I think they're great. But, and the other thing is the difference between the BSD license and the GPL, where you could take the BSD open source, you can change it, and you can create a binary, and you don't have to give the source code back. You don't have to make the source code available to the end user, right? And that is a problem.
Yeah.
I mean,
we've seen it used in ways that is not, you know, ideal.
Some companies who won't go named say they love open source, but that's because it cuts down on their development costs and they don't contribute back as much as they should.
Yeah. Right. Agreed.
So we wanted to talk about Project Kaha. It's amazing.
Project Kawan?
I know I'm not pronouncing it.
Kawan.
Well, it's actually Kawan. There's a little tilde on the end of it. It's Kawan. And that's because Brazil has the largest eagle in the world. And Kawan is a Tupi Indian word for eagle.
Okay.
Yes. It also happens to be the name of my Brazilian godson, who was born about 17 years ago.
Aww.
So...
You can tell you're a professor. We get lessons throughout the interview. That's awesome. I had no idea what that was.
So Project Kawan came about because I was down in Brazil, and I was at this conference, and this young student comes up to me and says, "Mad Dog, how can I make money with free software?" Now, there's many ways you can make money with free software, and all of us know a lot of those ways. You can sell services, you can write documentation, you can write books, you can
support,
you can give support and stuff, all that stuff. But what I realized was he was asking how he could make money with free software. And so I started thinking about the Brazilian culture and Latin American culture, actually. So I'm going to do a little test here. Have any of you been to Brazil?
No,
but Mexico, I did live in Mexico.
Okay. Well, if you think of Brazil, what's the first thing that comes to your mind?
Rainforest.
Okay.
The giant statue. It's like a religious Jesus.
Yes, statue. Christ the Redeemer.
Yeah.
In Rio de Janeiro. Yeah.
7-1.
Mm-hmm. 7-1.
Well, doing in Brazil, as you in soccer, there was a match where they beat them. They beat them 7-1, and they were expected to be destroyed. And it was like a complete flip. So it's also in, and a lot of people use it as a term to be like, you've been Brazil'd because you got beat that badly.
So soccer or football, as they call it. Yes. Carnival.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Carnival. Yeah. Yeah. And piranha, you know.
Yeah.
So all this type of stuff. But most people don't think about the fact that Brazil is the second largest city in the Western Hemisphere, with only Mexico City being larger.
Mm.
Manhattan is far behind. Yeah. And Sao Paulo, Brazil, has a population density about 12 times that of Manhattan. Now, to be fair, Manhattan is a lot of business, a lot of commerce and stuff with some people living there. But if you fly down, fly into Sao Paulo, just mile after mile of really tall apartment houses, really tall office buildings, and the office buildings are filled with small companies. You may have 20 or 30 small companies in this one tall office building. And so it's a very high density. And the University of Sao Paulo, which I started going to in 1996, the University of Sao Paulo has over 100,000 students and 16,000 PhDs.
Wow.
So almost anything that you want to know about, you have somebody at the University of Sao Paulo that has devoted their life to that.
Wow.
So I started going down there, started working with them and stuff like that, and really liked that. So I started thinking about, and one final thing. In Brazil, there's a lot of bureaucracy from the government, and it can actually take you between 6 and 7 years to set up a legitimate business. So that creates a lot of hardship. And commercial banks don't typically give out loans to people, particularly people who are trying to start a business. So it's hard to get the capital to start a business. So I'm thinking about all this stuff. And then what happened was President Lula, in one of his terms, looked at this and said, oh, I want to encourage small companies to start up. So if you're a company that has only one or two people in the company, I'm going to allow you to come to a website, fill out the website pay $10 and become a company with one or two people in it. And they called it the Micro Entrepreneur Act to get started with your company as one or two people. That easy, okay? And so I said, what would happen if I made it really easy for somebody to start a company? If I gave them a sample contract, a sample SOA, and I gave them some sample advertising materials, and I gave them some sample products to sell, and that they could take all of these and start their own little companies selling these products to people around their neighborhood and start to supporting them. So, for example, if you took a single board computer, maybe something like a Raspberry Pi, and you added a cash drawer to it and a printer to it and a scanner to it and a scale to it and a software called Udo, which allows you to make a point of sale and ERP system just like the ones you see when you go into McDonald's or you go to a small grocery or any grocery store these days, self-service scan did it. You can do that. You can make that with this and fill it in with software from Udo. The software from Udo is free and open source software. And there's in Brazil, there's 9 different companies that sell support for Udo. You could pay paid support for them.
Nice.
And I say, well, why can't the students take this software, put it on, Raspberry Pi, buy all this equipment and stuff, and they know it's going to work, and they sell it to a small store, and they help the small store set it up and start using it and stuff, instead of buying the $30,000.
Yes, Unix.
May have to buy a closed source solution from some large vendor who we will not mention, but rhymes with Boracle.
Oh, yes.
So in any case, I said, yeah, we could do that. And so we have a series of products there. And I really wanted at this scale to announce that Project Kawa was up and going and stuff, but I just ran out of time. So I'm going to have to put the premise of Project Kawa here at scale and say, just wait for a month or two until we have the entire web pages set up and everything.
Can we get involved in that project now as far as donations and things to help that project out?
Yeah, but you want to know something? We don't need any donations.
Look at that.
Awesome.
That's awesome.
That's
awesome.
We figured this out, so the whole thing is just so. But what you can do, so the way the Project Kawa is going to work is around the world, it's the same focus, right? It's students going in to earn some money to help them get a university education. So I'm going to explain that a little bit. In most of Latin America countries and a lot of countries in Europe and stuff, the tuition for federal and state universities is completely free.
Yes.
Okay. And if you're a qualified student, you've taken the entrance exams and stuff, and you've done good in high school, you get in for free tuition. However, about 40% of the students in Latin America cannot take advantage of this because of all the ancillary expenses, the apartment, the food, the internet, the books, the computers, the transportation stuff. Their families are too poor to pay for all that stuff. Sometimes they try with jobs like flipping hamburgers or being at a night clerk at a hotel, and they don't earn much money, and it's not what they're going to school for. So I said, if you're a computer science, a computer engineering major, why not do Project Kawan? And you have your own company, and you sell it to local business people, different products that they want.
Nice.
And, and you work for each one of them for like 4 hours a week, which they can afford to pay you. They can't afford a full-time systems administrator, but they can afford to pay you for 4 hours a week to do this. And if you have 6 customers, that's 24 hours a week that you're working at a pretty good wage, okay? And, we create the advertising materials to show these small business people how they benefit from having this student come in and do this work for them. And we train the student on how to sell. We train the student on how to write the contract so that they already have the technical information about how to do the job. Most of these kids have been supporting their family's computers since the age of 8. Okay.
Yeah.
They know how to install a new version of the operating system. They know how to change out a disk drive. They know how to set up the networking. You know, but the problem is they haven't learned how to ask for compensation for that because they're doing this for their mother.
It's kind of hard to ask your mom
how,
for money.
How can you ask your mother who fed you, who housed you, who cleaned your clothes, who wiped up your vomit? How can you ask her for compensation for helping her install a new app on her iPhone?
You can't.
You can't, yes. Right. But you can ask your neighbor's mother.
Yes, that's fair game.
And your neighbor can actually ask your mother because you're busy helping your neighbor's mother, okay? So we teach them how to do this. And we teach them how to do the Micro Entrepreneur Act, okay? So, and the other thing is that a lot of these kids are kind of shy and bashful and stuff. So we coach them in how to go and meet these business people.
Brilliant.
And we have another trick, a magician's trick. Okay? So for each group of students, we have a mentor. And the mentor is not necessarily a technical person, but they could be a business person. Somebody's done business before. And maybe they belong to the Lions Club or the Kiwanis Club or some Rotary Club and stuff. And they go in there and they explain the Project Cowra program. And then they say to these business people, how many of you would like to do this? And if they raise their hands, the guy gets their names and addresses and goes back to the Project Cowra students and says, why don't you go see these guys first?
Nice.
Nice.
Okay. And of course, now they've been briefed on this. They've accepted that the student's going to show up and stuff. And they make their pitch and they're more likely that they'll accept it, right?
Yeah.
And then after they've done that, once or twice, they got two customers. It's fine after that. Then they become the mentors to the next crowd coming in, okay? So this is why we don't need much money. We're going to, you know, the entire top part of the website, we have all the material for and stuff like that. I have videos done in English, Portuguese, and Spanish, which cover quite a few of the, and once we get going, we'll get more translations. And then the second level is country by country. We will have skeleton contracts and skeleton advertising materials. I hate coming out of an airport in Africa and seeing bleeding white faces up on the billboards, you know, buy our this or buy our that, you know. What, are you sick? Are you, you know? So we'll have reasonable, do never, never in a Japanese market have chimpanzees dressed up like human beings. Just turns them off completely. So appropriate advertising materials across all these. And then underneath of each country, we'll have little modules for the, you know, here's your mentor, you know, it's attached to this university or whatever. And we'll start working with the universities to say, this is another way that your students can make money in the financial aid department. You know, you have internships with companies. This is a chance for your students to start their own company to have, you know, to get the money to go through university.
Yeah. That's amazing. What an amazing project. So, unfortunately, I have three more questions, but we don't have enough time. So, I have in my head come up with a clever way of combining all this into one. Oh. Because I wanted to talk to you about AI. I wanted to talk to you about Arm and Risk. I wanted to talk to you about where we see open source going. And you know what? I kind of thought, looking at these, all those questions really are about where do we see open source going with AI, with Arm and Risk becoming more popular. You've seen the growth of Linux. You've watched it go and take off. What happens now? Arm, Risk, AI?
So we're going to start with Arm and Risk first. Okay. We're going to go back to 1935. with Alan Turing versus Maurice Wilkes. Maurice Wilkes was a professor, actually classmates with Alan Turing. Maurice Wilkes is credited with coming up with the idea of CISC computers, complicated instruction set computers, to warp the instruction set of the computer to the task at hand. Alan Turing believed in the RISC model. We make the hardware as simple as possible and be able to make the software, the compilers and stuff, generate the stuff, you know. I loved Dr. Wilkes. I really did. I met him several times. Really sweet person. But he was wrong. Okay. And RISC, yeah. RISC processors are the only way to go. If you take a look at the RISC-V, okay, you know, and the way they're going, a really, really small instruction set, but just the instructions necessary to run an operating system, and everything out of that is accelerators that can be done for specialized stuff that you can attach onto that. Okay. So, yes, RISC, CISC, die.
That's an easy one. All right.
All right. So now we think about the other thing, artificial intelligence, mm-hmm. okay? So I've done studies of the human brain, truly amazing thing. The synapses in the human brain can circle the earth about 67 times if you line them all up piece to piece. The number of neurons in the brain is just astronomically huge, okay? And we don't even know how the brain works, you know, completely. I look at artificial intelligence, and while I've been looking at artificial intelligence ever since the days of SAIL, I admit I haven't spent a huge amount of time on the actual mechanics of it, but I have differentiated between expert systems and sentient artificial intelligence. And what we have is not sentient, okay? It's a very complex, very, you know, huge amount of data going into the expert system, but that's what it is. Until somebody shows me something that proves it different, that's what is going to remain. However, if we ever do a sentient AI system, I want to make sure that somebody has the capability of turning it off.
Yep. It's Skynet. It's Skynet,
yes,
all over.
Yes,
again.
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, all of the science fiction programs of sentient AI, where it's particularly can improve and duplicate itself. If you haven't learned anything from that, please go and watch them, okay?
There are plenty to choose from, too.
Yes. And I really liked iRobot by Isaac Asimov.
Oh, that was a beautiful story.
The very end, the last story about the president of the universe and deciding that when he died, he was going to have his body completely destroyed. Yeah. But he had set up all these things that there was only one path forward, and the path was of peace and path of prosperity and stuff, that even though he was no longer the president of the universe, really people had no way forward except that path, okay? Okay.
That'd be wonderful. You know?
Yeah, but it's the machine which is manipulating
right.
humans, okay?
Yeah.
And in effect, you're saying that humans have had their ability of divine, you know, creation taken away from them.
Yes. I mean, I'm saying wonderful in the sense of like peace is the only path. That just sounds like a good thing.
It sounds good.
But also having the fact that you have no choice, and it's, you know, it is a.
I want peace, but I want us to do that from choice.
Yeah.
Choose peace.
Yeah. Imagine that. So we were going to do a lightning round, which I still have a couple questions. These are fun questions. Your character.
Yeah.
I have enjoyed this interview so much. Like, I enjoyed your history learning about you, but I could tell your character and in the way you tell stories is magical.
Actually, when you started saying that we don't have enough time, I was disappointed.
I am. Yeah, we need to have you back. I've got more I want to talk to you about. But for right now, lightning round, just the first thing that pops in your head, favorite Linux distro?
I don't have one.
Pancakes or waffles?
Waffles.
Good choice. Favorite band or musician?
Eagles.
What is your favorite piece of computer hardware, no matter the age, that you loved working with?
PDP-8.
There you go. John, thank you so much for meeting us. We know it took a long time for us to set up. We're in a foreign environment, too, here at Scale. Thank you for your patience.
Yeah, maybe.
But thank you for meeting with us and telling your story. I hope you'll come on our show and do it again.
Sure.
Yeah. I've got a whole list here.
I want to just add why I like the PDP-8.
Okay, yeah, love it.
Because first of all, it was built with discrete components. There was no integrated circuits in it or anything, discrete transistors. And that forced it to have a very simple instruction set. The machine was so simple, it could not subtract. It could only add.
Interesting.
You had to take a 2's complement of the number you wanted to subtract and add that to the minuend in order to get the answer, right? And the multiplication division was repeated and shifting of additions and subtractions and stuff like that. It did have a stack pointer, but, you know, so everything was put on the stack, everything went to the stack, and so that's why you learned recursive reentrant programming very well. You didn't have interrupts per se, so you had to do polling, you know, of your I/O to be done. Mm-hmm. So it was just a great machine to learn on, and because of all the software that was available through DECUS and the books you could get from DEC for like $5 that told you everything about the machine. Yeah.
Yeah.
Everything about the machine and how to program it. It was just wonderful.
Do you have one?
Yes, I have.
We got to do a, we have a treasure hunt on our show where Jill brings in this old, so we need to do a treasure hunt.
I don't think you remember to hold it up on camera.
Yeah.
Well, but the good news about, the really good news from my viewpoint about this is that a friend of mine named Bob Supnick, who was a vice president of hardware at DEC, when he retired, he decided he was going to write this simulator that could simulate all of these old DEC architectures.
Oh, neat.
And so you run this program, it's called SimH, on your Linux system, your Windows system, it's very portable. You run that, and then you can take old software from all these old systems and run them binary compatible.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
And so there's this guy, I think he's over in the Netherlands, he could be over in Italy, I've lost track. But he developed this whole set of computers, the PiDP-8, the PiDP-11, and now the PiDP-10, or the Pi-10, I think it's PiDP-10. And it's a front panel with lights and switches that when you flip the switches, it's like you're depositing the data, not into the Raspberry Pi, but into the virtual machine that's done in the SimH thing. So you can debug with these switches and lights the programs that you wrote on these systems. Awesome. You can single step instruction by instruction through the program and stuff on this. And all this old software is coming out of the woodwork from these companies. Like, you can get RT11, RSX11, Vistas E, various forms of Ultrix, BSD, stuff like this.
Amazing.
All for the PiDP-11.
Wow.
Oh, cool.
That's awesome.
So keeping it alive.
Yeah. If you do that thing on old hardware, particularly the PDP-8 or the PDP-11, you want to mention SimH, because, you know, even if you don't buy the hardware itself,
yeah,
you could. They actually have a simulated front panel for it that shows up on your X window screen.
Yes.
With the blinking lights and switches. Yeah. And you can touch the switches. But
that's very cool.
It's nicer to have the actual hardware sitting there in front of you.
Yeah.
That'd be awesome.
Well, it's been a privilege. Thank you, John.
Thank you so much.
Hey, we get to do something we never get to do in our virtual things. Thank you, John. I actually get to shake the hands of the person we're interviewing. And Jill, you have some additional interview stuff we're going to do. So we've got more coming.
So right around the corner, we have the Red Hat Summit happening May 6th through the 9th in Denver, Colorado. And Michael and I will be in attendance.
That's right.
Yes. It's going to be amazing.
To the Red Hat Summit. I'm looking forward to it.
Did you see all the cool stuff they have?
I did.
Like, there was an oxygen chamber.
Yeah, the oxygen chamber. There's also, I don't know if you saw this. There's a puppy petting thing, like a petting zoo,
so
sort of thing.
Much fun. The Linux Foundation events also do that. They have puppies, yeah. And one time they had rabbits.
It's a great way to relieve the stress of all of the
exactly.
network talks and all the cybersecurity stuff that's there, and all just they've got everything you can imagine. It's so full. You pick on this really great list of things every day that you can do, and there's no way you can do everything. Kind of like we talk about at other events, but This fest brings together IT professionals, customers, partners, and peers to make connections and support technology goals. And they have all kinds of technology you can put your hands on and classes where you can learn new things. So we hope to see you there. If you see us, I hope you're not wearing Crocs, but you can come say hi to us either way. Aww. And we'll be joining.
If you're wearing Crocs, it's okay if they are red.
Yes, that would be okay. And we're not going to have a booth, so we can actually enjoy talks.
We're going to experience a conference for the first time?
Isn't for the very first time.
Yeah,
it's going to be awesome. So if you're not already attending, maybe you should go ahead and buy your tickets. May 6th through the 9th, Red Hat Summit. And we hope you enjoyed that amazing interview. It was years in the making, and this was Jill's idea. And Jill has been so passionate about being able to make this happen and arranged everything and made it happen. So a huge and special thanks to Jill for
connecting us
with Mad Dog, because again, all of us said this is one of our most special interviews, and we hope you enjoyed as much as we did. And a big thank you to each and every one of you for supporting us by watching or listening to Destination Linux. However you do it, we love your faces. If you weren't watching or listening, we wouldn't be able to make awesome connections and have amazing interviews like that. So come join us on our Discord. Become part of this incredible community. Going to tuxdigital.com/Discord. And if you want to watch the show live, you can become a patron of Destination Linux. We're recording on Wednesdays. So Wednesday night at some time, what is it?
6 p.m. Central, 7 p.m. Eastern, and 4 p.m. Pacific.
There you go.
And if you're in Europe, I apologize.
We don't know. Something.
No, I just it's like 3 in the morning, so there's going to be a sleep. Yeah. So it's just sorry. It's just, that's it. Well, just sorry.
Is sleep more important than this show? I think not.
You're right. It's, okay. You have no excuse, people from Europe. Jobs. Whatever. And if you become a patron by going to tuxdigital.com/membership, you can join our Discord server and get access to the patron-only section of our Discord server. And like Ryan said, we record every week, and you can get access to that on our Discord server as well. And you can stick around for our patron-only post show that happens every week after the show. And you get all of this by going to tuxdigital.com/membership. And if you want to support the show and the network, you can go get some swag from our store, because we have a lot of cool swag. We have like the Tux Digital shirt. We have like t-shirts, hoodies, mugs, stickers, coasters, 33% more Jill merch, and even more coming soon. Unfortunately, Ryan was correct. I did not have it done when I wanted it to be.
Shocker.
And it will be coming soon, but that's all I can say is soon, sometime soon.
Make sure to check out all the amazing shows here on Tux Digital. That's right. We have an entire network of shows to fill your whole week with geeky goodness. Check out Linux Out Loud with Matt, Nate, and Wendy having a blast and sharing their awesome passion for Linux and open source. Everyone head to tuxdigital.com and subscribe to all our great shows. And don't forget to leave a rating on your favorite app so others can discover the power of open source and keep those penguins marching in the full Monty of Linux and open source. Awesome sauce.
And don't forget that rating is only 5. That's it. 5. 5 out of 5. Five. That is it. If they do it,
it's 10. What if it's a 10-star rating?
If it's a 10-star rating, you can go to 10. That's fine. That's an option for you. We'll give you. But okay. 5 out of 5, 10 out of 10. That's the only choices you can make.
And what if it's 3-star rating system?
You're making it too complicated. And then it's a terrible rating system. 3 is not enough, because 2.5 is very confusing about what that means. So if it's a 3 rating system, use a different app, because that's terrible. You need to get a better app and get a 5 out of 5 or a 10 out of 10. Either one of those.
Got it. Okay, totally now fine. I'm clear.
All right, good. Now that we've settled that, everybody have a great week. And remember that the journey itself is just as important as the destination.
Thanks, everybody. Aww.
See you next week.